welcome to A Bookish Home. I'm Laura Zaro-Kopinski, librarian and all-around book nerd. My guest today is Hank Phillippe Ryan, who's the USA Today bestselling author of 12 mystery novels. Hank has also won multiple prestigious awards for her crime fiction, 5 Agathas, 3 Anthonys, The Daphne, and more. She's also the on-air investigative reporter for Boston's WHDH-TV. She's won 37 Emmys, 14 Edward Murrow Awards, and dozens of other honors for her groundbreaking journalism. National Book Reviews have called Hank a master at crafting suspenseful mysteries and a superb and gifted storyteller. Her newest book is The First to Lie, a chilling psychological standalone. The Publishers Weekly starred review says stellar. Hank Phillippe Ryan could win a 6th Agatha with this one. And I agree, this book kept me up late turning the pages, and I'm really excited to get to talk with you today about it. So Hank Phillippe Ryan, welcome to A Bookish Home.
Thank you. I'm giving you a standing ovation for that wonderful introduction. I'm in the midst of writing my 13th book, and there are days when I think, oh, this is just never going to work. And hearing about things that I've done in the past is a really wonderful reassurance of, you know, sometimes it works.
It can be done.
Yeah, exactly. I love hearing your kind words and your enthusiasm. Thank you.
Yes, yes. This book is, you know, it's funny with everything going on. I've actually been drawn more to mystery and thriller because I really do feel like it just like takes me out of everything we're worried about, and it gives me different problems to stay up late worrying about the characters' problems, which is fun.
It is interesting, and I agree with you so much because it's always safe inside a book, you know, mm-hmm. And it's safe inside my writing desk. And you know, when you're in reading a book, especially a psychological thriller like The First to Lie or any of the wonderful books that are out there, you know, you exactly as you say, you're living someone else's life, you're solving someone else's problem, you know, the walls fall away, and you know, we're living through this really insanely horrible time. And being taken to another world is exactly what we're looking for right now. And I think that mysteries and thrillers are such wonderful puzzles that it is the perfect way to take our mind off of all the crazy things that are happening right now.
Completely. And I will say for yours, one of the things I loved the most about it, you're saying sort of the puzzle, I guessed wrong so many times. There's so many twists and turns. And I read a quote as I was kind of preparing for this interview where you said, my job with my author's sleight of hand and misdirection is to prevent you from figuring out what I'm about to do. And you do that so well throughout the whole book, just keeping us guessing, wondering who's telling the truth, who's not, who's in danger. I just enjoyed it so much. So I guess just to start, if you could tell us a little bit about The First to Lie and some of the characters that we meet in this book.
Well, three fast things about that. And I'm just sitting here smiling and smiling. I'm sitting at my desk in Boston, looking at the screen and smiling at you. And I know you can't see that. But, you know, when I was little and I was reading mysteries, I remember reading Murder on the Orient Express for the first time. Remember when you read that for the first time and I thought, oh, how did she do that? How did she get that ending? How did that happen? I wish I could do that. And so that Agatha Christie skill of having you turn the pages and think you know what's going on, and then in the end just pull the rug out from under you, or even in the middle just pull the rug out from under you. That's what I've always tried to do, give you an ending that's surprising but inevitable. And you think, mm-hmm. Oh, I should have seen that coming. I should have seen that coming. And writing my books, I have no idea what's going to come next. So if you say you were guessing about what happened next, I need you to know that I was guessing too. So when people say, you know, so many twists and so many surprises, I think, yeah, wasn't that a surprise? You know, who'd have thought that would happen? So I surprise myself on every page. And Sue Grafton used to call that the magic of writing, that you can create this other world that's surprising even to the author. And I always think that, you know, if I'm surprised, my readers will certainly be surprised. So the way I write is kind of, it's sort of getting when I get to the desk every day and I think, oh, I wonder what's going to happen next. Oh. That's what has me opening the manuscripts. So I hope that never goes away, that sort of writing magic. So you were asking about the characters or the story of The First to Lie.
Yes.
Well, you know, isn't that hilarious? Because, you know, I write domestic thrillers, suspense, and then I think, and then someone says, well, tell me about the book. And I think, well, no, I can't really do that.
I know. Well, that's, I'd rather you say it because I'm afraid of giving anything away with this one.
I figured out how to talk about it and see if you think this works. There's a wonderful game on Twitter, which is tell about your book in four words. So I thought, okay, I can tell about the book in four words. And that is betrayal, motherhood, obsession, and revenge.
Betrayal, ooh, I like that.
Motherhood, obsession, and revenge. And so that's kind of the key themes of it. And then for a little bit more about the story, I'll go to Facebook, because on Facebook, which we're all addicted to, sadly, there's a game of tell about your book in five phrases. So I thought, all right, there's a challenge. I can do that. So the five phrases are a devastating childhood betrayal, an undercover reporter who's in too deep, a beautiful sailboat on the Chesapeake Bay, a rich and powerful family, and an ice pick that is not used for ice. So bottom line, The First to Lie is two smart women facing off in a high-stakes psychological cat-and-mouse game to get revenge for a devastating childhood betrayal. But which woman is the cat and which woman is the mouse? And that is The First to Lie.
I love that. It's so good. But it's so interesting. So to hear you say that and then think back about how you're saying you were surprised as you were writing. I was sort of imagining that you have like, I don't know, a giant whiteboard that has everything sort of like plotted out and lines connected to everything. I mean, how do you keep, I mean, yeah, what is the writing process like for you?
Well, I would do just about anything to have a nice whiteboard like that. I have to tell you, there are days when I'm sitting and looking at my computer thinking, oh my golly, I have no idea what happens next. Well, this is going to be interesting. But I can't make outlines like that because to me, and I know that every author handles this differently, and I know you've talked to so many authors, and I know every author has a different answer for you, and that must be so fascinating for you to hear. But for me, if I said to my editor, she says, why don't you make an outline? And I say, well, how do I know what happens until it really happens? And it doesn't really happen until it's in the pages of the book. So my brain, the way my brain works is if I make a plan, the characters are going to start doing things that are not to that plan. And the reason they do things that are not to the plan is that they actually are real people in the book. And I'm not trying to be woo-woo or weird about this. I know it's writing. I know it's my brain. I know it's my subconscious. I know it's my conscious mind. And I know it's storytelling, and I know how to tell a story, I think, after all these years in television. But when you, Dennis Lehane talks about that a good book is you get some interesting people and put them in the same room and have them all want different things and then just let them crash into each other. And that's how I write. I have characters who care about something and who want something and who will, and I'm seeing how far they'll go to get it. And that's how a book evolves, isn't it? It's about somebody wanting something and then someone puts an obstacle in their way and it's the decision that they make about how to get around that obstacle. And in that decision making is revealed the personality of the character. And we then know what they want and whether they're making a good person's decision or an evil person's decision or a selfish decision or a decision that's a mistake based on an error or based on a misconception. That's what makes a story interesting and whether they're keeping a secret along the way. So who has a secret? What is the secret? What will happen when that secret is revealed and how far will someone go to stop that knowledge? that those are all the engines of a novel: secrets and conflict and protection and desire and passion and obsession. That's what moves the story forward. So I have a yellow sticky. You talk about the whiteboard. I do have two yellow stickies on my computer. One of them says psychological. And that's because sometimes what we do to each other, the mind games and the manipulation and the gaslighting, is just as devastating and just as deadly as a gun or a knife, just as destructive, right? What we do to each other psychologically. And that's what's in my books. I don't like graphic violence. I don't like inappropriate language, but I do like that deception and manipulation and mind games and gaslighting. So psychological. And then another one of my stickies says, advance the plot, advance the plot. So I don't want, the pages of description or internal thought or wondering about things or sitting around talking, the parts we skip. I just don't write those. And so advance the plot, and that, advance the plot, psychological, deceptive, and manipulation. And I filter everything that happens as I write through those words. My readers, it's sort of, I make a contract with my readers. You're getting psychological suspense, realistic, relatable, psychological suspense. And I think about that sort of in a parallel track as the story evolves. So I don't know what's going to happen around the next corner when I'm writing. As I said, I sit down and fire up my computer to find out what happens next. And that's my writing process. It's difficult. It's a sort of a tightrope to sit down and write chapter one, type chapter one, and then think, well, I wonder what's going to happen now. So, you're 100,000 words to go. And I have no idea. So it's daunting, but so rewarding. When I hear people like you say, oh, I love your book, I think every single minute of that uncertainty is worth it.
And it's interesting the way you described sort of the components of your book, what it is and what it's not, being a psychological thriller. I don't think I could put my finger on it before why it's this kind of thriller that I like, because I think I'm very sensitive to like a book being too violent or too dark. And these, I feel like, just as you're saying, it's more about the psychological aspect of things. And, it was making me wonder, as you were saying, about sort of, moving the plot along and not including any of the things we would skip over. Does that sort of relate to your like journalism credentials? Is that?
Yes, yes. Really good question. Really good question. I didn't start writing till I was 55, where after I'd been a reporter for 30 years or so. And I do think that, there's a huge and massive storytelling aspect to reporting. But as an investigative reporter, what I do is I follow clues and track down leads and do interviews and go to places and get video and go undercover and in disguise and carry a hidden camera and all those kinds of things. And it may take me weeks or a month to put together a story. So I may have hours and hours and hours and hours of videotape that I have to edit together and make a script and then create a little movie of what's the most important thing that the viewers need to know. And the story has to make sense. It has to be riveting. It has to be compelling. It has to be unique. It has to be new. It has to be educational. It has to be enlightening. It has to be revealing. I don't want you to turn the television off when you're watching my stories. So it's exactly the same technique in writing a novel. There's a whole lot of important stuff, there's a whole lot of stuff that goes into it, but I'm only going to take, and I've learned after all those years as a reporter, only to take the jewels from all that extra chaff and weave those jewels together into a story, a story about an important problem that needs to be solved with a character who you care about, where the good guys win and the bad guys get what's coming to them. And in the end, you want some justice. And you want to change the world a little bit. So I learned how to tell that story, with a beginning, middle, and end. And not to put it, I don't have time in television. I'm not allowed in television to put in a bunch of extra stuff. It has to be No tangents, no digressions, no diversions. You know, as a matter of fact, when I'm writing and I write this beautiful, gorgeous paragraph, and then I think, well, that's all going to go. You know, that's not central to the story. And there, it inspired me to make every word do all the work it can. And to make every sentence do all the work it can and have as much subtext as it possibly can, not just to mean one thing, but layer and layer and layer. The first to lie, you know, that even the title can be read on so many levels. My books, Trust Me and The Murder List, those titles can all be read on so many levels. And that's what I'm trying to carry through in the book as well. So I want you to, you know, the highest praise for a reporter is, wow, that's a good story. You know, when a reporter hears that, you know, we just cheer. And that's exactly the same thing that I want in a novel. I want you to miss your stop on the bus, you know, because you cannot remember buses, because you cannot put the book down, or just, you know, you want to stay up for one more chapter into the middle of the night reading because you just can't put it down. And that's what I'm going for in writing. And I do think, all those years as a reporter, and I'm still on the air in Boston, all those years as a reporter have informed that process, that flat out basic storytelling process that grabs you by the throat and doesn't let you go. And in the end, you think, wow, good story. And that it changes your life a little bit. You know, that you don't, I want, when people read The First to Lie, I want them to look at their world in a little different way afterward. How you think about your family, how you think about your siblings, how you think about your parents, how you think about your visits to the doctor, how you think about who you trust. You know, I want you to have the little bit of lingering memory of not only having read a good story, knock on wood, but that something is a little bit changed in your mind and emotion. And that's what I'm going for as well.
Yeah, it's very thought-provoking. And it got me wondering, two things. Were there any stories that you worked on that inspired this at all? And just in general, when you are doing your investigative reporting, are you kind of on the lookout for interesting characters that you might want to include in your books?
Let me answer the character one first. You know, it's interesting because there isn't anyone in any of my books. My mother would have told you something else because she says she is my first series, the Charlotte McNally series. My mom always thought that she was Charlie McNally's mother in the book. And she is, you know, she was, but I would never admit that. But otherwise, there's not a person in any of my 12 novels who is based on anyone else. They're just, they're just fictional people. But what is in there? What is in my books is all those years of experience of having people confess to murder, or, you know, being at murder scenes, or chasing down criminals, or confronting corrupt politicians, or, you know, wearing a hidden camera and going in disguise, going undercover, all those kinds of things. All that genuine, authentic experience, the emotion of the experience, the ethics of the experience, the decision-making process of the experience, all that goes into the book. So that's why people say, oh, it feels like it's really true. And I think, well, yeah, because it could be true, that they're very realistic, very relatable, very believable stories, because I've lived through things like that. And in answer to your question, yes, indeed, this book, The First to Lie, was, what is the word? Inspired. The first domino that fell in the story was a story that I did 10 years ago, you know, or 15 maybe, before I even ever thought about writing. And when I decided to write a novel about manipulation and deception and mind games in the world of doctors and medicine and pharmaceutical industry, I realized that I knew a lot about that from stories that I had done in the past, including one where I went in disguise and undercover into several doctors' offices to find out whether they would tell me the truth about their malpractice loss history. And it was scary. Carrying a hidden camera is scary. It's not illegal, but you know that the doctors whose offices I visited undercover and in disguise would not have been happy had they known I was taping them. Not that it was illegal, but it would have been unpleasant to be caught. I've only been caught once. But as a result of those undercover investigations, new laws were, the laws were changed in Massachusetts about the ability for the public, for potential patients, to find out the legal histories of their doctors. And that experience, and so that was a big deal. And that experience of how it felt going undercover and how it felt, and this will, you will get it now, how it felt to be someone else, it really informed The First to Lie, because that the doctors that I included in the story all lied to me. And they lied for selfish reasons, to cover up their past, to lure me into being a patient of theirs, which might have been dangerous for me had I been a real patient. And so bad, 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 right? But I, as a reporter, as the good guy, I was also lying. I was misrepresenting myself totally. I was saying that I was a woman who was trying to get pregnant. Not true. Not true. But I was lying for good, for a good reason, which I thought was good at least. I was doing what I thought was good for the bigger picture, good for the public, good, you know, something that could help my community. And so that was okay for me to be the first to lie there. And I started thinking about how we're always all undercover, right? I behave differently with you than I would with a stranger or with my husband or with my boss. You know, we be who we need to be. And I started thinking about what if being someone else could get you what you want? How far would you go to be someone else if it got you what you had always been obsessed with? And that, you know, so that's sort of the path of a story, how it starts out as one thing and evolves into something else in the writer brain, and how you can't make an outline, I can't at least, make an outline of that, because that's a magical writing brain process where real life experience blossoms into fiction. And that is what, as an author, I hope daily will happen. That something that I think of will trigger something else and trigger something else and trigger something else. And that will blossom into Ellie and Nora and Meg and Brooke and Lacey, who you meet in The First to Lie, all of whom are obsessed with something and all of whom were betrayed and all of whom are looking out for trying to get revenge. But they can't all succeed. And that's what the story is about.
I think that's so fascinating. And just with your experience, how there is so much emotional truth and just those details and that experience. I think that's so interesting. And it makes me wonder too, you know, what made you decide to write that first book? And what was that journey like from kind of deciding you wanted to do it to getting published?
Oh, that's so funny. I mean, it's such a good story, and I love it. And it proves on so many levels how you never know what's around the next corner. We learned that kind of crazily right now. But back then, you know, I grew up in really rural Indiana, so rural that you couldn't see another house from our house. And as I said, I love Sherlock Holmes and Nancy Drew and Agatha Christie. And I always wanted to write a mystery novel, but then I wondered maybe it would be better to be a detective than write about a detective, sort of be Sherlock Holmes instead of write about Sherlock Holmes. And so I became a reporter. But gosh, when I was 55, which was 15 years ago, ridiculously enough, I just one day at Channel 7 had a really good idea for a novel. I mean, I knew it was a good idea. And I came home and I said to Jonathan, my husband, I've got a great idea for a mystery. I'm going to write a book. I'm going to write the book I've always wanted to write. And Jonathan says, well, that's great, honey. You know, do you know how to write a book? You know, and I honestly remember, and I get goosebumps telling you it, I remember saying to him, how hard can it be? You know, I've read a million of these. I've read a million mysteries. And I soon learned how hard it could be. But that idea became Prime Time, which won the Agatha for Best First Novel. And that was the beginning of my crime fiction career. If I knew then what I know now about the difficulty of getting books published by a major publisher, I would have been so intimidated that I'm not sure I would have had the courage to go on. But I was just so naive, and so confident about this idea. I knew this was a good story when I was writing Secret Messages in Computer Spam is what Prime Time is about. And it's still in print. All my books are still in print. Prime Time is still selling like hotcakes, and people still love it. And I'm so proud of Prime Time, and it holds up beautifully. But it shows you. And as I said, I was, you know, I was 55 at the time when, you know, I had a really wonderful career as an investigative reporter, successful by any measure. But I really wanted to write this book. So I'm sort of the poster child for following your dreams in midlife. Right. You know,
I love that.
And so it's too late. It's too late. I am the total proof that it is not too late to just follow your passion like you did.
So I would imagine with the investigative reporting that is, you know, all consuming in so many ways and probably very unpredictable when it comes to your time and your schedule. Where does the writing piece come in? Just like late at night, early in the morning? What's your...
In early on, when I started writing, I was working full-time at Channel 7, 5 days a week, and every single other moment of my life was spent writing every weekend, every night. My husband is so adorable and so supportive. And we didn't take a vacation for 6 years, I think, because I took all my vacation time to write. So I was completely devoted to it. A couple of years ago, though, I decided that, knock on wood, that if I don't really focus on writing now, when am I going to do that? So I pulled back to working part-time at Channel 7. So I work essentially 2 days a week at Channel 7 and 5 days a week on my novels. And my husband said, "Oh, that's great, honey. You know, now you work every day again." But I do have 37 Emmys, and I think, do I need 38 Emmys? Well, I kind of do, but I do think that I'm going to declare success in reporting and sort of focus on writing now. I can't give up being a reporter. I love it too much. And our system works beautifully. And I'm still on the air in Boston and still working on fabulous stories. But if you talk about my focus is slowly shifting to completely embrace, the books are doing really well and I'm really happy about that. And, you know, I get fan mail, and it just brings tears to my eyes when people say how much they love my books and when will there be more. And it's very, very exciting. So, you know, again, you just never know what's around the next corner. And I'm very honored and thrilled that writing crime fiction is sort of the second half of my life. You know, I when I finished writing Prime Time, my first book, I called my husband into the room and I said, "Sweetheart, watch this." And I typed the end. And I burst into tears. You know, I really burst into tears because I knew somehow, you know, the way we know things is, you know, I knew that my life was about to change. I didn't know how. And of course, as I said, I couldn't have predicted what would happen. But I knew that I had done something that I always wanted to do. You know, that little girl back in Indiana had wanted to write a mystery, you know, at age 9. And now all those years later, I had finally done it, and it turned out to be very successful. So, you know, I think about sitting there at that computer and typing the end and crying and think, wow, I should have applauded instead of crying, you know, because it wasn't the end at all. It was the beginning.
I think that's so inspiring. And even just, I just think it's so lovely to see, you know, that you do still have, you know, that passion for investigative reporting. Just such a wonderful view of just a really full, rich career and life that you're so passionate about. So I just think that's really cool. Well, I always love to end by hearing what authors are reading. Are there any books you'd want to recommend to listeners?
That's such a good question. You know, one of the wonderful things about being an author now is that I get to read a lot of advanced review copies, authors who want me to read the books with an eye to a cover blurb. And that is such an honor. So right now I'm reading the new Catherine McKenzie book and the new Christina McDonald book. So they're very excited about those, and you'll see them coming out soon. I recently read, and I was sort of late to the party, about Ellie Griffith's The Stranger Diaries, which I completely recommend. It's her first standalone, and it won the Edgar. And again, I embrace that book completely, The Stranger Diaries. And then there's this author, a British author named Andrew Wilson, who writes a series of novels with Agatha Christie as the main character. And they are brilliant and they are hilarious. And it's one of those things where I think, why didn't I think of that? You know, that is a good idea. And I really have to recommend the new Rachel Housel Hall book, And Now She's Gone, which is a really terrific private eye book. Rachel Housel Hall is quite a brilliant writer, and I'm very happy to be able to tell you all about her.
That's great. I will link to all of those and to your books. And of course, The First to Lie. And it just made me wonder too, you know, if a listener picks up The First to Lie now and really enjoys it, you have so many wonderful books. Where would you suggest they start next after The First to Lie?
That's a great question. And thank you. My book, The Murder List, which is now nominated for the Agatha, Anthony, McCavity, and the Mary Higgins Clark Award, the only book to be nominated for all those four major awards, The Murder List. So what somebody said, if John Grisham and Lisa Scottolini had a book baby, The Murder List would be it, which I think is such a good description. I write cat and mouse thrillers, and my book, Trust Me, my first standalone, is my first cat and mouse thriller. And I'm very delighted about how that came out too. So any of those other two, The Murder List and Trust Me, I highly recommend. The Jane Ryland series, beginning with The Other Woman, which won the Mary Higgins Clark Award. So fantastic. The Other Woman is the first of the Jane Ryland series, which you can read in any order. And then, as I said, Primetime, the first of the four Charlie McNally series, which is sort of Nick and Nora Charles sensibility set in Boston. So any of those, and you can buy any of those books on any platform, and they're all in audio, and they're all also in large print. And you can find them all on my website as well, and links to everywhere. I think The Murder List is on sale right now. So,
wonderful. And I meant to say, too, for local listeners, because I'm also in Massachusetts, it was really fun to see The First to Lie set in Boston. And I think, are all your books set in Boston, I thought?
They are.
That's fun, too, for any local listeners. I always like to read books set in local destinations. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to come on. I hope that listeners pick up the books or get them from their local library and spend some time this fall and winter curling up with a good thriller, good mystery.
My pleasure. If you come to my website, any of your wonderful listeners come to my website and click on contact, that comes right to me with nobody in between, or find me on Facebook and Twitter and Instagram. So crazy, but I'd love to talk with you. And this has been just great. Thank you for the honor of inviting me today.
For links to all of the books mentioned on this week's episode, you can visit abookishhome.com, and there you'll also find a link to our new online bookshop. A Bookish Home has teamed up with the new organization bookshop.org, which supports independent bookstores. And if you'd like, you can browse books by authors who have been guests on A Bookish Home. I'm also sharing there all the books mentioned on the podcast, books I've been reading lately, and other recommendations. It's a really wonderful site to browse and look through books. And if you make a purchase, it supports A Bookish Home and independent bookstores, so it's a win-win. So if you want to check that out directly, it's bookshop.org/shop/abookishhome. And you'll also find that at abookishhome.com. If you are enjoying the show, I hope you take a minute to subscribe and also rate and review in iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you enjoyed this episode, I would encourage you to share it on social media to help other people find the show and this episode. Thanks for listening, everyone, and happy reading.